Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Força Armada assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
I want to be nasty. Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
आज जो पार्टियां यहां शोर मचा रही हैं.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país. Nada. Absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Yeah! Hello there, and welcome to PALcast, a podcast by the Project on Autocratic Legalism, or PAL. I'm Fabio de Saia Silva at the University of Oklahoma. PAL is an effort to understand how law can be used to further, as well as to resist, autocratic forces that have been on the rise around the globe. The project involves scholars from multiple countries and disciplines, and has been given the status of an international research collaborative by the Law and Society Association. PAL participants are currently conducting research that looks into autocratic legalism in Brazil, India, and South Africa. You can learn more about the project at autocratic-legalism.net. PALcast is sponsored by the OU Center for Brazil Studies. Research and sound production for this episode were provided by Ahmed Abdelaziz. My guest today is Javier Corrales. Javier is professor and chair of political science at Amherst College in Amherst, Massachusetts. He got his PhD in political science from Harvard University in 1996 and has a very prolific and successful career in comparative politics and Latin American studies. Corrales' research focuses on democratization, presidential powers, and democratic backsliding, among other topics. His latest book, Fixing Democracy, Why Constitutional Change Often Fails to Enhance Democracy in Latin America, was published by Oxford University Press in mid-2018. Corrales is particularly important to the efforts in this podcast because he's the scholar who coined the term autocratic legalism to account for Venezuela's authoritarian turn in the last 20th century. And according to Corrales, this involved the use, abuse, and non-use of law by the executive branch, which means law was central to the process by which the executive came to amass power, sideline the opposition, and avoid accountability. As you will see in the interview, Corrales develops this account on quite traditional political science grounds. He's very concerned with separation of powers in the executive overtaking lawmaking and law implementation functions. He sees autocratic legalism as a deviation from this ideal model of government that he believes should be strengthened and protected. But his analyses also invite intriguing questions about, for example, how autocratic legalism works and how it is enabled or constrained by arrangements in political economy and international relations, which, of course, becomes very important at the time when there is a presidential transition in the United States, and many hope that the Biden administration will stand up for democratic values in the country as well as globally. Here's the interview. Javier Corrales, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You happen to be the one who coined the term autocratic legalism in a paper on Venezuela that you published in 2015. I wanted to start this conversation today by unpacking your definition for this term. It seems to me that the question that your paper is trying to respond to is why what comparative politics scholars call hybrid regimes become more democratic or more autocratic. And autocratic legalism appears in this paper and in this context as a tactic by which those in the executive get to concentrate more power to the detriment of non-state and opposition actors. Is this a fair representation of your argument? And if so, what does autocratic legalism involve?
Thank you. That is a fair representation. I think the concept of autocratic legalism is part of the study of the process of becoming more autocratic in one way or another. And what we have seen is that in the both autocratic regimes as well as democracies that are becoming more autocratic, there is a real emphasis and obsession on the part of actors who are driving this process to produce a legal facade to what they're doing. They probably think that that gives them some legitimacy, some connection to the rule of law. So they do this, and which means that it's hard to criticize them legally because a lot of what they're doing seems to be protected by the law. And so I started thinking about, well, you know, let's see what's behind it. Why do they do this? And how, despite the legal facade, there is significant abuse of the legal apparatus. So I think of this as the use and abuse and also lack of use of the law. But the law becomes a fundamental part of the process of establishing the new non-democratic regime. And that's what I was thinking of when I wrote that article about Hugo Chavez.
And that makes a lot of sense to me. If we think that hybrid regimes, by definition, have both a democratic and an autocratic side, autocratic legalism would be the use of law to boost the autocratic side, that is, the powers of the executive, and suppress the democratic side, that is, accountability mechanisms, political opposition, and civil society activism. My question, though, is this particular to hybrid regimes, or even in what political scientists would call a consolidated democracy, there is an ambiguity that potentially renders these polities vulnerable to the rise of autocrats? And if so, what is democracy ultimately dependent upon?
Right. Well, you know, there are democracies that may engage in autocratic legalism, but let's be clear. In a consolidated democracy, in a consolidated liberal democracy, definitionally at least, there has to be separation of government functions. This is a very basic concept. And the executive branch cannot be the court, nor can it be the law. When we start talking about autocratic legalism, what we begin to refer to is already deviations from that model, in which the executive branch begins to adapt functions of legislation as well as adjudication. They are the most important driver of this process. And that is already taking us away from at least the ideal way of what liberal democracy should be about. And then, going back to what you were saying, Fabio, the real purpose of autocratic legalism is to use the law, as you say, to give tools to the president to go after its enemies, to apply the law, sometimes ensure that the same law, the same standard, doesn't get applied to the president. So it's definitely weaponizing the law. And I don't think there's a single person who studies liberal democracy who says that in a democracy, law can ever be weaponized with the purpose of giving powers to the president and injuring the opposition.
Wonderful. It seems that communications and the media are central in your study of Venezuela's autocratic turn. And I guess we all understand that autocrats would like to control people's access to information and the narratives about their government, and that they would use government power to do it. But what has become of this in the digital age, when it seems that spreading misinformation through social media and non-state networks, for example, has become an even more efficient political tool than controlling narratives through state-sponsored media?
Aha. Let me begin by saying that autocratic legalism as a tool to repress the media has been far more effective in constraining the traditional media, radio, television, and the written press, than the digital media. So we should talk about what's happening in these two domains. There is no mistake about the fact that autocratic legalism is often deployed to create enormous restrictions on what the traditional media can do, especially their business models. Not just the content, but they go after the traditional media as business operations can and cannot do and restrict them. And in many cases, the autocratic legalism ends up basically vanquishing the majority of the traditional media. So then there is a migration toward digital sources. And in digital sources, there is a bid to the digital world. There, I have to say, and I may be wrong, I don't know that autocratic legalism is as effective for these presidents in dealing with the excess of information in the digital world. Perhaps what presidents use in the digital world is creation of echo chambers, character assassination, making sure that there is no mechanisms curating information, spreading rumors, creating a sort of like my camp really should just listen to me and insulate them from listening to everything else. But yes, the question is fantastic, because presidents need an alternative tool to deal with digital media.
But it doesn't seem that this inability of presidents to regulate social media has hindered their autocratic projects. On the contrary, they seem to take advantage of this lawlessness of social media to, again, spread misinformation and conspiracy theories that favor their assaults against accountability mechanisms and civil liberties. How does this conflict with or corroborate your idea of autocratic legalism?
Right. So this is a very important concept to keep in mind. In the United States, this is the concept of fake news, but we have seen this in Latin America. When presidents begin to attack the experts, what they're also doing is getting people not to trust reliable sources of information, to think that anything that happens in the world of production of information is full of biases and lack of professionalism. So once you create that environment, then people don't trust the real authorities, and then they begin to trust whatever, or they equate them. And so this is what is beginning to happen in the digital media. In the digital media, there aren't people curating information. And if on top of that, you create a discourse that the experts really are no experts, then you completely undermine the ability of this media to be able to exercise a quality check on the information that is being reproduced. And that's very scary. This is what we now know is an incredible way in which a new revolution in information that was supposed to democratize us has ended actually empowering the more powerful forces in society, in this case, the executive branch.
Another aspect of your work that I find quite fascinating is how you place the Venezuelan case in a larger context of international political economy and international development, with Venezuela using both diplomacy and foreign aid to build alliances that shield it from international pressure. You also mentioned, for example, that the rise of China and Russia globally, which are not liberal democracies, may have enabled the autocratic shift in Venezuela. And I absolutely agree with you that we have been on the verge of abandoning the democratic consensus globally. But I also ask myself, where did the democratic consensus fail that it became an easy prey to these autocrats?
Well, in the 2000s, Venezuela was able to take advantage of two major complaints about liberal democracy back then. One was that liberal democracy was run by the same old elites, not economic elites, but the same political leaders, and that we needed to have a participatory expansion. New people need to come in. And as long as new people are the ones making decisions, this is democracy. Even if those decisions are being made in a dictatorial fashion, if there were new people, then it was a big opening. And the second thing that Venezuela took advantage was coming out of the neoliberal era, which was so predicated on budget cutbacks. So Chavez discovered, well, let's spend. And as long as we're doing this, we're doing social democracy. So it was an opportunity to disguise autocracy, disguise the rise of a dictatorship with clothes that seem like you were expanding participatory democracy and social democracy, because the government flaunted both things. Flaunted the extent to which new actors were now going to be making decisions and we're going to spend heavily. And back then in the 2000s, perhaps we were a little bit naive, or perhaps we were so hungry for breakthroughs in participatory democracy and breakthroughs away from the economics of adjustment and austerity of the 1990s that we welcomed this new show. But now we know that ultimately a rise of a semi-dictatorship and a demise of pluralism in Venezuela. But it was very well disguised. And I think that's one of the things that work. So many of these autocratic publics, in order to make the case more theoretical, will always exploit a grievance in society that it's widespread. And they need to be able to give the impression that they are addressing it. And if they succeed in that act, then they can get away with a lot of erosion of liberal democracy. This is the Venezuelan lesson, that if you manage to address some of the societal grievances in society, citizens will go along with a project of aggrandizing the powers of the president. And we thought, believing in John Locke, that citizens would never go for that, that citizens would never give up their political rights, that citizens would always defend institutions of accountability. But we now know that they're willing to give them up if they like the show.
And how can we avoid the trap of autocracy or autocratic legalism, but at the same time not foreclose avenues to democratic innovation and expansion and social democratic projects in the economy, for example?
I think this is the big debate at the moment. How do you contain this? Given the appeal of some of these autocrats, what are the strategies that you have to use? Let me tell you the strategy that I don't like. The strategy that I don't like is to emulate the autocratic legalism, but going to the other ideological side. So if you're fighting a Chavez who's on the left, then you propose hardline politics on the right. Or if you are fighting Trump on the right, you propose hardline policies on the left. I think that extremism actually, in the end, ends up helping the very same autocrat that you're trying to undermine. What we're starting to see is that policies of moderation, of trying to create a big tent, of creating a coalition that is open to folks who are both on the left and on the right, but who hate the discretionary powers of the executive branch, is the way to go. And that means that the opposition has to be ideologically very moderate in order to be able to be a big tent. In order to create, to use the language of the Federalist Papers, a counterbalance to the autocratic populist strategy of the other side. Unfortunately, once this type of approach becomes mainstream, it is very difficult to send it back and for it to disappear. So you have to offer a competitive poll, and that competitive poll has to become very big tent ideologically. And maybe that's the challenge. It's very, very difficult to create an electoral coalition that is comfortable, a welcoming home for both, for people who are on the right and on the left. But that's what you have to do based on the idea that these are folks on the left and on the right who find it very dangerous to have an autocratically, a system that is based on autocratic legalism become consolidated.
So let me build on that to ask your opinion about the recent elections that we had in the United States. I know you have also written shorter pieces about the Trump administration, warning the American audience that Trump was following the path of autocratic legalism. At this point, it is unclear whether Trump will concede his defeat and allow for a transition of power to Biden. But assuming that he will, what do you think are the more long-lasting effects of the Trump presidency to democracy? And what do you think that Biden should do to restore democracy and the rule of law in the United States and globally?
So I think that Trump has done a significant damage because he has been able to take a party that was a big defender of liberal democracy, the Republican Party, and turn it into a party of people who are very eager to go along with autocratic legalism and authoritarian populism. So that damage is already done. We have lost a conservative party in the United States that respects and admires and wants to defend liberal democracy. It is a party instead that wants to defend a particular view, ideological position, come what may. So that damage is already done. Now, what Biden needs to be able to do is a little bit of what happened after Nixon in the United States, or what has happened, to give you another example, and I know it's terrible to use the example of Peru now, where Peru is not having a wonderful moment in liberal democracy, but Peru after Fujimori, or let's just say Mexico at the end of the PRI, you need to go and build very strong institutions, reinforce institutions of checks and balances. Pick a few. It could be the electoral system, it could be the courts, it could be certain laws of corruption. It wouldn't be very difficult, for instance, for Biden to create new laws about, forcing public sector workers to disclose tax returns. So simple things like this. This is probably sort of like safeguards into the future, reinforce some of the institutions that were left in place. And that is definitely, we have seen episodes in the world where we see countries enter autocracy, sort of like begin to enter that sphere, and then turn around, and the groups that can come afterward manage to try to reinforce the institutions and the levies in order to be ready for the next battles that will come into the future. They're never remedies for life. They are just reinforcements. But there will be future battles, and who knows whether they will do their job. But that is, I think, what Biden needs to do. And it's interesting. This is you are asking a very important research question, the politics, what happens oft after autocratic legalism? How do you fix it and protect it from happening again, protect the legal system from happening again? Very important question.
Very good. So just before you go, I wanted to ask you to open up your library to those of us who want to study these issues in more depth. What are the three key readings that you would recommend to our project and audience?
Well, if you're interested in this question of autocratization, how democracies become more semi-authoritarian and even autocratic. I think you want to read a little bit on the latest literature on populism, and you can, you know, there are two important authors, John Werner Mueller at Princeton, or Cas Mode, who wrote a great short piece with a Latin Americanist. And both of those on populism are very good. I would also recommend the book by, it's this German scholar, Jascha Munk, called The People Versus Democracy. Because there, there's a very good discussion of how citizens in advanced democracies have developed a distaste for experts, a distaste for people who have been professionally certified. And it covers many, many topics, but when it gets to that point, I think that book is just absolutely great, because it is in many ways a condition that allows for autocratic legalism to occur. And probably another book that I really, really love, less so about democratic backsliding, it's by a woman named Erica France, called Authoritarianism. And it summarizes the latest research on authoritarianism currently. And it tells you, this is what the new autocrats share with the old autocrats, but this is what's so new about them, and how they are in many ways emulating aspects of democracy. So I would say those three books are some of the best books I have read in the last 2 years on these topics. These three, well, I mean, I mentioned four authors. I mentioned Cas Mode and Jan Werner Mueller on populism, Jascha Munk on the concept of people versus democracy, and Erica France on authoritarianism.
That's Javier Corrales. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you like our series, please share it with your friends on social media. They can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have comments or suggestions on the series or our project, feel free to contact me at fabio.desaiasilva@ou.edu.